turn the tables on Trump? The GPM speaks with an expert on the matter, and shades of Dr. Strangelove. An obscure tech titan wants to rule the world and has come up with a manifesto. All hail the AI-based technological republic. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm Dave Kattenberg. Before diving in, a quick appeal. If you appreciate what you're hearing, please help out. Subscribe to the Green Planet Monitor at greenplanetmonitor.net. Now, the news with Kylie Wong.
The Strait of Hormuz has become a dangerous place to ship fertilizers, essential for global food production, and for aid groups trying to reach stranded seamen in need. Around 20,000 seafarers are currently stranded on around 2,000 ships in the Persian Gulf, unable to leave due to Iran's closure of the Strategic Maritime Passage. They're facing extreme stress, security threats, and shortages of supplies, with some reporting having to ration food and water, says Bob Kitchen, Vice President for Emergencies at the International Rescue Committee, IRC. Aid agencies are burning through budgets rapidly, he says. It is more expensive to buy fuel to run our operations, moving commodities, than moving personnel around many of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa, Kitchen said. A new program tackles climate change while helping immigrants break into skilled trades. In Ottawa, a social enterprise called Build is training immigrants to retrofit homes. Buildings are a major source of greenhouse gas emissions. Canada must retrofit about 600,000 homes annually to meet net zero emission goals. The Ottawa program teaches insulation and air sealing, helping new immigrants break into the construction industry while making homes more energy efficient. Late last month, 60 countries gathered in Santa Marta, Colombia for groundbreaking talks about phasing out fossil fuels. Convened by Colombia and the Netherlands, the Santa Marta gathering was the first to focus on complete energy transition. Other meetings will follow, organized by something called the Fossil Fuel Treaty Initiative, solution-focused discussion outside the traditional international climate architecture is what the initiative is all about. In Santa Marta, delegates agreed to create national roadmaps for transitioning new renewable energy. But challenges remain, including continued fossil fuel expansion and limited financing for decarbonization. Still, the Santa Marta conference is seen as a potential turning point towards coordinated global action on climate change. This is the beginning of a new global climate democracy, Irene Vélez-Torres, Colombia's environment minister and chair, said. Meanwhile, U.S. authorities have approved a new pipeline to carry Canadian crude south, dubbed Keystone Light, in reference to the canceled Keystone XL project. The 650-mile Bridger pipeline expansion would carry up to 550,000 barrels of oil daily from Canada through Montana and Wyoming. While much of the route follows existing corridors and private land, the project still requires further environmental approvals. Supporters say it will bolster energy supply, but environmental groups oppose it, citing spill risks and climate impacts. Legal challenges are expected. The biggest concern we see right now is the risk of spills, said attorney Jenny Harbine with the environmental law firm Earth Justice. And that's the news.
Thanks, Kylie. This past Monday, Donald Trump swore that Iran would be blown off the face of the earth if it doesn't immediately restore maritime traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. Late last month, Trump predicted that, quote, a whole civilization will die, unquote, if Iran doesn't do what he wants. Weeks earlier, Trump vowed to send Iran back to the Stone Ages. That's the plural. If Iran didn't lower its neck to U.S.-Israeli imperialism, well, Iran doesn't seem to be listening. Indeed, according to numerous informed observers outside the Trump administration, the Islamic Republic has actually turned the tables on Israel-USA, scoring what many see as a strategic victory over the conjoined entity. To catch up on the current situation, the GPM reached out to Arang Keshavarzian. Arang Keshavarzian is Associate Professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at New York University and the author of a host of books about Iranian history and politics. We reached Arang Keshavarzian in New York City.
Israel-USA launched its assault on Iran on February 28th, and it was clearly unlawful under the United Nations Charter. It unequivocally violated Article 2.4. I'm looking at an interview with Una Hathaway. She's the professor of international law at Yale Law School, one of the world's leading scholars on the legal order governing war and the prohibition of use of force. She says, quote, this is Una Hathaway, "The U.S. and Israeli war against Iran is clearly and unequivocally unlawful." So now I'm looking at the February 28th statement by Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations, and he won't say that. He said, "I condemn today's military escalation in the Middle East, the use of force by the U.S. and Israel against Iran, and the subsequent retaliation by Iran undermine international peace and security." And then he goes on to say, "All member states must respect their obligations under international law, including the Charter of the United Nations. The Charter clearly prohibits the threat of the use of force against territorial integrity or political independence of any state." But he does not say, he did not say that the attack violated Article 2.4 of the United Nations Charter. Can you comment on this? Because we don't, I mean, anti-imperialists, pro-Palestine solidarity people, and not just legal scholars, quick to say the attack was flagrantly unlawful. But we don't hear this in the media, and governments are not saying that, certainly not Western governments.
No, absolutely. And I'm glad you kind of in a sense started with that, because we've definitely lost sight of this. And the mainstream media, let's call it, definitely just completely sidestepped this issue. Absolutely. By all definitions, this is an illegal war of aggression, whether you look at it from international law, but even in terms of U.S. law, as I suspect your listeners have been following some of the debates in Congress, while some Congress members of Congress have spoken out and have tried to push the War Powers Act debates, but it has no legal standing even within the United States. Now, for me, this is part of, in a sense, a culmination, if you will, of a quarter century of gradual whittling down of international institutions, the United Nations, even NATO for some in many senses. And, you know, the gutting of the notion of multilateralism, or even really meaningful multilateralism between governments and institutions. And unfortunately, this is, you know, with beginning with the Iraq war and continuing since then, this has exposed much of the world's population to kind of brute force and U.S. ambitions for global primacy. And in a sense, what we've seen in Iran this past couple months has been kind of a culmination of what we've seen, as you mentioned, unfolding in Gaza and elsewhere. The only last thing I'll comment on, there is a kind of a Iran-specific dimension to this, especially in the United States, and that is that we can't lose sight that for 47 years, basically, the U.S. public has been exposed to a kind of demonization of Iran, of the 1979 revolution, of the Islamic Republic. This goes back, of course, to the overthrow of the Shah, the hostage crisis, but also the U.S. support for Iraq's invasion in 1980. So at least for older Americans, and here there's a generational split, I think, at least for some or most older Americans, Iran has been viewed as a pariah for decades. When we look at the polling, it's clear that doesn't hold water for Americans under the age of 30, even under the age of 40. But I think that's also part of the story of why you can just run roughshod over law and to a war of aggression.
And the Western powers, with the United States at the lead, purport that Iran is the single most malign entity on the planet, and that it threatens global peace and security. It's a direct threat to the United States. It spreads terrorism all around the region and around the globe. There is no force as unlawful and as malign and as evil as Iran, which kind of astonishes me, because Iran is surrounded by, I don't know how many dozen U.S. military bases. It's completely surrounded.
Yeah, and those were the ones that Iran targeted as soon as the war began on February 28th. No, and you know, it's strange. This administration has come to power in the name of America First, and you know, putting an end to these endless wars. But it has this sort of real, when we look at Venezuela, Cuba, and Iran, it's these it's these kind of very sensitive, very ideological cases that Donald Trump and his cabinet are really focused in on. They're clearly are moved by trying to overturn these, you know, these long-term enemies of the United States. You know, I agree with you. This is a U.S. story as much as an Israel story. I know a lot of people on the left, even on New York Times, have pushed this argument that Israel was behind this war. But Israel was pushing on an open door. You know, people like Trump, but also Marco Rubio and others in his cabinet are perfectly happy to go for these wars, assuming that they're going to be quick and painless for the U.S. economy, for the U.S. Population. But they're interested in it. We saw this in Venezuela. We see it in their discussions about Cuba as well.
It's interesting, just all the commentary, and it seems to be pretty uniform everywhere except White House press briefing sessions, that Iran has turned the tables on the United States and Israel, and it may, some say, have actually scored or maybe on the path to scoring a strategic victory over the United States, completely changing the power balance in the Persian Gulf and wider Southwest Asia. So I want to ask you your thoughts on that. Has Iran actually turned the tables, and how much damage has, well, there was the June assault and then the late February assault by Israel and the United States. Trump and Pegasus say they've decimated Iran. So how much damage have they actually caused? And how do we square this damage with this idea that Israel, that Iran is actually in the process of achieving a strategic victory?
Yeah, so well, I definitely agree that this was a strategic blunder on the part of the U.S. And Israel, that, you know, their main claim is that they wanted to attack Iran, at the very least to dismantle its nuclear program, really radically weaken its military, and ultimately with the goal of overthrowing the Islamic Republic. They haven't achieved any of that. They have bombed Iran very heavily, and that's all they've been able to do. And actually, we're now in a situation where the discussion is not about Iran's nuclear program. It's about a Strait of Hormuz, something that was open on February 28th. So in that sense, I absolutely agree with analysts who describe this as a strategic defeat or setback for the United States. But I appreciate your question that, you know, what's missing in some of this discussion is that Iran, and specifically Iranian society and economy, has been battered by this enormous bombing that took place for 40 days. And we can't lose sight of that. A lot of the media has paid attention to the global consequences, the price of oil, disruptions to shipping, even the rise of fertilizer prices and the potential of food shortages and all that. That's absolutely true. But when we zoom in on Iran, on the one hand, the regime hasn't been broken. It hasn't been overturned. But Iranian society is suffering immensely. Not only have thousands been killed, majority of them civilians. We're talking, the exact figures are not clear, but definitely over 3,000 and 4,000 have been killed. We're talking about over 100,000 just residential buildings have been damaged. Some estimates put the damage at billions of dollars of damage, right? And this is damage that can't be repaired in 1 or 2 years. And what's important, it definitely can't be repaired under heavy international sanctions, which are still imposed on Iran. You have to think of the international sanctions as economic warfare, right? So Iran is really suffering. Its basic infrastructure, we're talking about ports, airports, maritime ports, key manufacturing sectors such as petrochemicals, steel production, all of this has been damaged. Just to give you one little data point, over 60 civilian airplanes have been damaged in the war, just civilian airplanes. And this is already has had dire consequences for Iranians. Inflation, the already a very high inflation rate has only climbed well over 50%. And for food and basic goods, it's in the 100% range. The value of the local currency is declined precipitously, especially this past couple weeks. And maybe most importantly, it's really generated a wave of unemployment. A lot of it's directly related to the bombing. So the factories that were bombed, the manufacturing sites that were bombed, This has led to work stoppages, where people have been losing their jobs. But a second part of the story is that Iran's decision to shut down the internet has had enormous consequences. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of Iranians who've either lost their jobs or lost income due to the shutdown of the internet as well. We're talking about the gig economy being affected, but also artists, researchers, writers, people of various sorts, women working from home, selling goods, for instance. This has a huge consequence. The UN Development Program actually estimates that over 4 million Iranians will fall under the poverty line in the coming weeks and months because of this various ways that the economy has been strangled by the combination of war and the responses of the regime, including the internet shutdown. The last two points out areas I'll just point to is there's we don't know the full extent of it, but the environmental consequences of this war, like any war, are dire. In this specific war, we're talking about the oil spills in the Persian Gulf. We're talking about toxicity from bombings, whether it's polluted air or polluted soil. I suspect many of your listeners remember the sites of the acid rain after the Israeli bombing of the refinery, for instance. We don't have a full documentation of the environmental degradation in Iran and the broader region, but it's massive. And then last, let me just point to the destruction of historical sites. A lot of this bombing happened in major urban cities, Tehran, Isfahan, and others. And these are dense urban fabrics, old cities, hundreds of years old. So we're talking over 100 historical sites and museums that have been damaged during the war. Many of these are on UNESCO heritage sites, for instance. Some of it is minor damage, but a lot of it is quite extensive and will take years to fully repair and account for. So we can't lose sight of this. While on a geopolitical plane, yes, we can talk about U.S. Strategic defeat and Iran's military acumen and its kind of asymmetric warfare protecting the regime. But the question that many Iranians are asking, will ask, is, well, okay, if the regime was protected and in some senses the state was protected, what cost and who's bearing the cost of this war? And definitely in this, at least in the short term, the cost has been is fallen on the shoulders of ordinary workers and ordinary Iranians.
Is Iran still able to produce gas, produce, store and ship gas, oil and gas? I gather it is.
Yes, I think what you're pointing to is this the Trump strategy this past couple weeks of imposing a blockade on the Strait of Hormuz with the goal of preventing Iran from exporting its oil and gas for financial gain, but also put it on this pressure where it's going to have to shut down the oil fields. From what I have gathered, Iran is not at this stage. Iran still has some storage. And from some of the shipping kind of channels, shipping platforms, trackers suggest that Iran is still getting some of its ships out into the Indian Ocean for export. So it's not there yet. Analysts in Washington, these hawkish think tanks, projected that Iran will run out of storage within 10 to 13 days. We're now approaching 3 and 4 weeks now of the blockade, and Iran is the oil facilities are still functioning. They're definitely going to be strained, but Iran has been under international sanctions for many decades. It has borders with Pakistan, with Turkey, and the Central Asia and so forth. It knows how to navigate these difficult situations. So there's no quick fixes, and that's what Donald Trump and the supporters of this war are looking for.
And let's talk about these alternative trade routes other than through the Strait of Hormuz, like down from Russia across the Caspian Sea. I mean, Iran has borders communicates with Russia directly across the Caspian Sea and across Azerbaijan, Iranian, and transport happens along that route. And from Pakistan, there are numerous alternative routes that can substitute for the Strait of Hormuz.
No, absolutely. That's why the idea of the blockade, just in a couple of weeks, strangling Iran is far too simplistic. Dubai and the UAE is a major trading partner for Iran, but so is Turkey, Armenia, and so forth. Pakistan border is an important avenue for Iran as well. So that all is in effect, especially when you think that, you know, some of these countries are sympathetic to Iran and at the very least have economic interests in having good economic relations with Iran. I'm talking about Turkey and Pakistan, for instance. Since you mentioned Russia, you know, there's a lot of discussion to what extent Russia's support for Iran is important. I mean, we have to acknowledge that Russia's bogged down in its own war, so I doubt that Russia is going to become directly involved militarily in the war or conflict with the U.S., but from all reporting that we've seen these past few weeks, it's clear that Russia is sharing information with Iran. And this may have helped Iran's ability to target U.S. bases and U.S. Assets in the Arabian Peninsula and elsewhere. So Iran does have international isolation, but it's not completely blocked out from other diplomatic channels. In some ways, it's the United States in these past few weeks that has been isolated, right? It continuously keeps calling other countries to help it in its war effort and opening up the strait. And whether it's Europeans or obviously China and Russia, they've turned their back on the U.S. So it's the U.S. and Israel that have been more isolated, in my reading, than Iran in many senses.
So the question I ask is, how is it that Iran can keep fighting? Of course, right now we're in supposedly a ceasefire, but if the war begins, we can imagine Iran will just slip right back into it. How on earth, after this incredible pummeling it received for 40 days after the end of February, how is it able to still send out fast boats and threaten to fire missiles? How can it do this?
I'm not a military expert. I don't have the information to get into the military tactics and so forth. But the thing for me, what's important to acknowledge is that this is a regime that is, in a sense, fighting for its survival, fighting for its very basic survival. So this really is an existential issue for the Islamic Republic. And the Islamic Republic is not just the Ayatollah, right? Ali Khamenei was killed on the first day. And the idea that I think people in Washington and Tel Aviv, or at least some people in Washington and Tel Aviv, had was that once you kill the Ayatollah and a few other generals and so forth, the whole system would collapse. That was proven to be foolhardy. I think most serious analysts and experts and people knowledgeable about Iran knew that, were saying that this is not going to be a simple Venezuela style, just remove the leader and the whole thing may unravel, or so, even like Iraq in 2003. This is a well-entrenched, institutionalized system with multiple power centers who work together in a kind of coalitional sort of way through committees and through consensus building. And that's what they have done, even after the assassination of Ali Khamenei. So the regime is still quite organized, quite powerful. It may not have a lot of popular support, but it has whatever the number, 15-20% of the population are directly integrated into the regime, whether it's economically, through social welfare, through ideological and religious channels. There is a social base that this regime has. And from what we've seen, and this is difficult because of the internet shutdown and so forth, what we've seen is that social base, again, whatever that number is, that few million Iranians, have been mobilized by this war effort. And they have taken to the streets every evening and have expressed their support for the war and for the regime. So this is sort of the paradox, right? The war has given the Islamic Republic a new lease on life rather than upending it. If we had this interview back in January or February, I would have been far more pessimistic about the ability of the Islamic Republic to withstand popular opposition, right? I'm talking about the January uprisings, the protests that brought Iranians from many different walks of life together around economic issues, but also social and political rights and so forth. And the regime was truly vulnerable in that sense. But today, it has the war as the language of war, as the language of friend and foe, enemy, and so on and so forth, to securitize society, to shut down spaces for critical dialogue and for the expression of political pluralism, which does exist in Iran. But under a war condition where you have the United States and Israel threatening Iran at every turn, that space for actual political debate, discussion, articulation of alternatives, for demands for reforms, for demands for loosening the internet restrictions, they're not available to ordinary Iranians. I'm not very good at projecting into the future, but I don't think this is sustainable for many, many months or many years. Hopefully, this war will wind down, and when it does, Iranians will have to deal with this aftermath, which is quite dire for their ordinary lives. But also, they have the political kind of tools and politicization, and the kind of the political demands that they've been expressing for a number of years now that will again confront the leadership in Tehran. And so, while it may look like the Islamic Republic is strong and powerful on the international stage, it will face enormous domestic challenges around reconstruction, about unemployment, inflation, and all of those things, but also political demands that Iranians have been articulating for four, five, 6 years now.
How authentic are those demands? Is that community that it has over the years expressed antipathy towards, even hatred towards the Iranian regime, the theocratic regime? Because we, of course, if we listen to Washington, the brave, noble Iranian people who hate their regime, if we listen to our anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist friends who talk about how the protests in late December and January and February were all concocted by the CIA and, of course, Mossad, and the CIA boasted that they had actually placed protesters on the street. And none of it is legitimate. None of this protest is real. How much antipathy is there for the theocracy in popular circles and in popular strata within Iran, and influential, commercially influential intellectual circles in Iran?
Yeah, no, I'm definitely familiar with the argument among some on, let's call it the left in outside of Iran, that says that, look, these protests that we saw back in January, but even in earlier years, they're minor, they're small, and they're supported and kind of concocted by Mossad and the CIA and so forth. I mean, my position has been for a number of years, but even going back to January, is that clearly the U.S. government and Israel is invested in overthrowing the Islamic Republic, and as I mentioned earlier, it has been for decades, since even it's the inception of the creation of the Islamic Republic. And clearly, for instance, Israel does have assets inside the government. All of the assassinations that we've seen over the past, assassinations of scientists and officials and so forth, during the summer war last year, clearly Israel had, whether it was the Israeli agents themselves or allies within Iran, who are creating trouble, right? Who had access to information and so forth. And I wouldn't be surprised if the US and CIA does it as well. However, two things can be true at the same time. While that's there, and I think many Iranians are aware of that, there's also major grievances in Iran, major issues. If our colleagues on the left care about working class people, the protests that we've seen, not just in January, but almost on a daily, weekly basis, are led by working class people, nurses, truck drivers, oil workers, you name it, all different segments of Iranian society. It's not just the upper class, Western-oriented Iranians and so forth. We're talking all different stratas of Iranian society. So for me, I take my clue from those groups. And those groups have been fairly consistent over the past few months. They've said no to war, no to foreign intervention, and no to monarchists outside in the diaspora, such as Reza Pahlavi, but also yes to fundamental changes in the Islamic Republic politically, economically, right? They've been chafing under privatization, under the gutting of regulations, and under a really deteriorating economy. A lot of that is the fault or is because of sanctions, but a lot of it is also because of deregulation of the economy, of mismanagement, of corruption, and it has created rampant inequality. So